Welcome to the Ortho Joe Show, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. In our world, orthopedic research is king, and current topics from our respective publications are analyzed weekly. Here is Mohit Bhandari from Ortho Evidence and Mark Swinkowski from the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
Well, good morning, Mo.
Good morning.
I suspect you might just be a tad jet lagged. I'm not really sure about that, but you and I just got back from 4 days in Japan with our colleagues there going over the details of how to really do high quality clinical research. And it was a great audience and we had a good time there. And I suspect you're back at it as a chair of surgery at Mac and solving problems right and left.
Just have one just 2 seconds ago, one just showed up. You know, like they say, Monday mornings and Tuesday mornings are kind of like there's a meteor coming. You just don't know when it's going to hit. And then boom, it hits and you got to deal with it. So here we are. But this is.
Yeah, well, I have my Ortho Joe mug full of Joe because I am a little bit jet lagged in. For our guests, this is the absolutely priceless Ortho Joe mug that you'll be receiving in the mail as a token of our appreciation. And you have to guard these things because people want to steal them. They're just not available in the general public. And since Seattle is such a coffee drinking place, I would guard it with your life. But our guest is Dr. Robert Winquist, who is, I would say, an icon in the field of orthopedics and orthopedic trauma in particular. And I am one of many individuals who were mentored by Dr. Winquist, and I owe him a debt of gratitude for a lot of direction. He was responsible for helping me to get a fellowship at the laboratory in Switzerland under Stefan Perrin for a year helped me struggle through clinical problems early in my practice and taught me all the basics of IM nailing. And Bob, I would say that, you know, in orthopedic surgery, people say the total hip is the operation of the century. And in orthopedic trauma, I would say, and I believe Mo would agree, that the operation of the century is the IM nail. And I know that you always credit Kuncher. I've heard you lecture on Kuncher and his contributions many times. But the audience will know that you were the author of the seminal publication on IM nailing of the femur in, I believe it was 1984. But so, Bob, welcome. And if you would, can you just kind of tell us the story of IM nailing and your career and how that all came together?
Be happy to. So I was going into internal medicine, and May of my senior year of medical school, I, for some reason, took a 1 month clerkship in orthopedic surgery. And between that and Harborview, where I'd already worked a lot as a student, I just went straight down the rabbit hole. I switched mentally from internal medicine to orthopedics in a hurry, did a straight medicine internship in Dallas, Texas at Parkland. I arrived, my first month was an elective. I could choose anything, neurology, cardiology, anything. And I chose the surgery pit, which was the name for their emergency room down there at Parkland. And the Department of Medicine wondered, who is this guy? So I learned a lot about general surgery there and resuscitation of patients and things. So it was great. And then I went into residency. I missed the draft shutdown for Vietnam the year I came out of training, out of internship, and went into orthopedics. Then went up to Seattle. And very early on in my residency, I got further enthralled with Harborview and with trauma and with nailing. And that's what started it out. So open nailing was being done in this country, where you open up the femur and you pull a shaft out and you ram a rod up through the top, out through the top, back through the bottom. And it actually worked pretty well. The complication rates were higher and things, but it offered a lot. But Kuncher had done closed nailing and felt that was the way to go. And I think because he lost the war, that we didn't get to hear as much from him as we should have. But There was a German surgeon in Seattle who gave me Kuntzscher's original 1945 book pamphlet that I looked at, and most of the answers are still in there. So I always refer people back to 1945 if they want to know about nailing. So I give Kuntzscher a lot of credit. And for me personally, a lot of credit goes to Ted Hansen. So Ted was a farm boy from Eastern Washington who was used to fixing tractors and things and has an unbelievable three-dimensional ability. So three dimensions, I think four, he must have four dimensions. So he unfortunately died recently, but he could put anything together. So I think that it was really important. And early on when we were doing this, it was hard for me. I was a resident doing a lot of this research and stuff, and I would get up and give presentations, and well-known people in the country would stand up in the audience and scream, "That's malpractice." And I was a little shaken as a resident when that happened. And I'd go back to Ted and I'd say, "These people are saying we're doing malpractice." And I said, "What should I do?" And he says, "Well, just do whatever's right." That was his advice. Just do whatever's right. And I said, "Well, where do you get your information?" And he goes, "Well, I don't go to anything east of 9th Avenue. Well, 9th Avenue is where Harborview is. And if you go west, you fall off into the ocean." So he just kind of did what was right. And he had this great skills. And they had already been doing closed nailing before I got there, not very long. So I just jumped in. And I was fully on board, very interested. All the things people said we couldn't do, we were doing. And it worked out well. And one of my favorite things was we had straight nails only. These were straight Kuntzscher nails. There's a differentiation between nailing and rodding. So nailing is an open section nail, and you put it in tight, and it actually holds a lot. So this was before interlocking. And with a closed section nail, if you technically did it, full length nail, clear down to the end of the femur, clear to the top, large size, tight fit. You could do a lot of things before we had interlocking nails, which then came along and replaced that. But we had only straight nails. And every operating room at that time and probably still has a utility sink. So back where they clean the instruments after they come out of surgery is a utility sink that has about a 3-inch pipe going down to the wall. And you can use that pipe and the wall to bend nails to make them curved. So before surgery, we'd get a lateral x-ray of the normal size, a normal side, and look what the curve of that individual's femur was. And then we'd take the nail down to the utility sink, bend it to get the right bow, and then flash it while we're getting the patient ready for surgery. So we'd pre-bend the nails. And one day I was asked to go over to the university from Harborview, which I went over there a little bit to help them out, and was doing this infraismal fracture that needed a curved nail. So I'm down in the utility sink at the university, pre-bending a nail, and Viktor Frankl had just become chairman of the department. And Viktor's a great guy. I like him a lot. But he'd written the book on biomechanics, and he knew that if we bent these nails, that it would weaken them. So he called down and said that I couldn't bend a nail and use it. That was not a good thing to do. This is calling down from the office. And I said, "Well, then I'm leaving and you can come and do it," he said, "Okay, well, you go ahead." So that was pre-bent nails. And I became interested in that. Every place across the nation we used to do cases with, there was real cadavers. And at the end of those, I would always collect the bones and have them shipped back home. And so I would do lots of studies on femurs. I would do x-rays and curvatures and starting points and all sorts of things. And that was really, really terrific. So I was lucky to collect a lot of bones. And I got complaints at home when various drawers or cupboards were open and some bones would fall out. That didn't go over very well. But I was very lucky to collect and do a lot of things. And later, I went up to Toronto, up to Canada, where Grant of Grant's Atlas had a collection of bones. And I did a lot of studies up there too, so that was great. And then
I'm going to let you go ahead, but then I'm going to ask Bob to tell the story of the seminal JBJS publication. But you go ahead; I'm sure you got some.
I'll go right into that. Actually, one interesting thing about that study is that a big problem now with with clinical research is you can't get follow-up. So, you know, the percentage of follow-up has become really, really difficult. And back then, it was a smaller community. Seattle isn't a real big town. And all the orthopedists around the state of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Alaska, I knew really well. And so I could get follow-up. And I knew who the aunts and uncles were. I could go to people's houses and get follow-up. I knew which bars they went to. And I could go talk them out of the bar to come back for an x-ray. And so a great thing about that study was a higher percentage of follow-up that you just can't get today because the population is so mobile. And yeah. I was able to get fantastic follow-up. So that was important. So anyway, after studying all these and having pretty good, really good follow-up, I just sent it into JBJS for publication and they sent it back all rewritten. So they rewrote the whole article and it really didn't follow the information and didn't sound very good. And I didn't like it very well. And so I said, no, thanks. And that was it. And then 2 years later, they said, well, could we have that article? And I said, yeah, if you won't change it. And they said, okay. So that's how it came about. And I'm not only not a very good writer, I was a poor writer, but I did know the information. So I put it down the best I could and published it, and that helped things out.
Change the field. That absolutely changed the field. Go ahead, Mo.
Yeah, there's so many places to go with what you've just told us, but the place that struck me is, you know, I too remember, you know, my residency days and getting up on a podium and presenting information and getting hammered by an audience member and just thinking, oh my gosh, like what is going on here? And I think I may have done something horribly wrong, going back to my mentors and saying that didn't go very well. You know, it truly rings a bell when you were doing something that ultimately now everybody knows that, you know, what was happening and closed nailing was absolutely the way to go. When did that tide change for you? Was it after presentation of data? Because early on, it sounds like there was quite a bit of pushback. When did you, like, do you recall the moment or the period in which things suddenly changed, in which people fully became, you know, flipped over and believing that what was happening in Seattle was in fact the right thing to do?
I think Mike Chapman was doing a lot of it in San Francisco too, so it was sort of a West Coast thing. Well, one interesting thing, when I presented it at the Academy, the series at the Academy, you know, he'd go up on stage with the various panelists that are speaking that day, and Gus Armiano was sitting next to me, who did a lot of cast brace work, and he was just shaking, I'm a young guy, and he's shaking next to me, and he says, aren't you nervous? Because I was going to be presenting next, and I said, I don't feel very nervous, and he says, aren't you nervous? And I still wasn't sure if he was nervous or was trying to make me nervous, which one it was, but anyway, the tide changed slowly, so it crept from the west to the east, and I think I started doing an instructional course when I was a fourth-year resident, maybe. Anyway, I started doing the instructional course at the Academy with Ted Hansen. The participation there just grew over time. So initially, people were coming and kind of skeptical, but interested. And then they were very interested. And I think about 5 years or so, it was moving. It probably took 7 to kind of get across the country, I would think, something like that. And then people were very interested. They wanted to come and learn and do all those things and attend courses. And the doubters were doubting less. And the other alternatives of traction and cast bracing, those sorts of things were not leading as good results. And people understood it. Actually, when we started, there were very few image intensifiers around. Right. So actually, that was a big part of it. And we got such a big series early on because people would send us cases from all around. They'd put them in a U-Haul truck and haul people up in traction in a U-Haul truck from Oregon. And so the image intensifier was a big part of it and wasn't readily available. Did that answer the question?
That's amazing. Yeah, that was perfect.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story. You have had a huge role in it. And you said you're a poor writer, which I don't believe is true at all. But you are a great presenter of information, and you have some principles that are really pretty straightforward. in that you have like two words on a slide, and you mostly fill it in by speaking to the audience. And it's super effective because people aren't spending all their time looking at your slides. And how did you figure that out, Bob?
Now I understand. I had learning disabilities, so I didn't understand it at the time. I was pretty blind as a kid, so in first grade, I had to sit in the front row to see the board, and from that, I learned that I always needed to be in the front row, because if I got further back than that, all the chatter going on, I just got lost. So I sat in the front row, I paid attention, I took vigorous notes all the time, and then I would reformat it. So I'd reformat it so it made sense to me. And so I think my learning disability fit in with a lot of orthopedic surgeons. So I figured I could boil things down. So you said a two-word slide. I considered that one of my long slides. So the one-word slides were the better ones. And I was just able to boil things down because I had two for myself. I'd boil them down to one or two words. And from one or two words, it was all there. So I just fill in a few more words, but it was, that's how it came about. So it was probably based on learning disability.
Well, as I said, it's just incredibly effective. It's kind of like you were the early author, really, of the TED Talk type of orthopedic presentation. And I hope that there are some younger academics who are listening. And it's just much more effective when you're speaking and the audience is listening and there's no distractions of videos going on and stuff like that. So I think it's a real advance that you developed, and unfortunately not too many people have followed it. The last thing I want to ask you about is you are a clear decision maker in your career. You make a decision and you don't look back. And I know we had a chance to catch up at the OTA in Seattle, and we were talking about the retirement thing. So, and I know for a fact that many people have tried to get you to speak at orthopedic meetings since you retired, and you won't do it, which is admirable, but it also makes me very grateful that you've agreed to talk to Mo and I on Ortho Joe. But can you just chat a little bit about how you made the decision to retire and the fortitude, I guess, to just not turn around and look back and start a different phase of life?
I saw people fade and I didn't want to fade. And I thought, well, I'm all in. So I was working like crazy, like you guys are. And there were a lot of places I wanted to go south of the equator. I took care of my own patients. So I never wanted to be gone more than a week as a rule, because I always wanted to make sure the patients were okay and that I could take care of any problems. But I wanted to be gone longer than that. And so I decided that when I retired, it would be a full stop. And as far as lecturing went, I had the attitude, if you weren't doing it, you shouldn't talk about it. So I thought that I saw people lecturing that weren't really doing the stuff. And I know that I'd done it up to that point, but I felt if you're not doing it, you shouldn't be talking about it. So that's why I quit lecturing. And I still feel a little mixed about that, because I probably do have some things to offer, but I didn't want to do that. So I stopped, and people voted against me. They thought I'd flunk retirement. And about 3 months into it, I woke up one morning and I went, what am I going to do with myself today? And that lasted until 11 o'clock that morning. And that was the only episode I had. And then I've been lucky to, well, I do a lot of outdoor stuff. So I go to Africa and Antarctica and all kinds of crazy places that take a while to get there and back. And then I've been very involved in Native American art and the Native American people. And we've collected stuff for 40 years. We have some great stuff. Edward S. Curtis was the greatest photographer of the United States. And I've been fortunate to interact with a lot of the Native Americans, learn a lot more about their issues. And I have six grandkids, and I'm just very fortunate.
Well, that's great. You know, speaking about your interest in travel, I'm going to end with a story, but perhaps Mo has one last question for you, Bob.
Well, you know, I mean, the only thing I was going to ask is you've had such an influence on so many people, Bob, you know, just, you know, who have learned from your writing, from your work, from your example. Can you speak a little bit to your relationship, and I guess your and the influence Dr. Hansen had on your life?
Yeah, it was pivotal because it was, you know, he was doing the work. Actually, one thing was is that it was so easy for him. It was just, you know, trauma wasn't really his interest. His interest was the foot. And trauma was just kind of something he did. And it was just like automatic and like there wasn't anything to it. And I learned a lot from him, and partly to follow his example of just do what's right. So at that one. And it's a little hard if you're defining what's right yourself, but still, that's that was it. And it was just a great example. And one time, I think I was a second year or third year resident, maybe, and I'm doing a nailing, and we had visitors there, and he was unscrubbed doing the fracture reduction. So he's under the sheets reducing the fracture. And I'm thinking, I'm really doing great here. I'm really a pretty good surgeon here. And one of the visitors lifts up the sheets and looks underneath and he says, I know who's doing this operation because all there is to nailing is the starting point and the reduction. The rest of it's easy. So I did know the starting point by that point, but I didn't fully realize how difficult it was to do the reduction. And his three-dimensional ability made that simple. So the visitor recognized that. And I still remember him lifting up the sheet going, I know who's doing this operation. So he was just a great influence on me and a lot of people. And he hung in there, and Harborview is a fantastic place. And he's made it, and it's fantastic because of him. And Mike Kopas, who really set up the emergency stuff. And I was lucky enough to train all the original paramedics and very involved in that part of it, too.
Well, I'm going to end with just two quick stories. So first, I was an intern at Harborview. And Bob Hett was one of the developers of a new instrument to do closed shortenings of the femur. And in this particular patient, he did something I haven't seen since. So he took a segment of bone out of one side and lengthened the other side. So it was a female patient, I remember. Obviously, these were open procedures. But I remember like it was yesterday. Bob was there all night, worried about the sciatic nerve function, coming in to examine this patient as an attending all night long. So his passion for appropriate and careful patient care is unmatched. The second is on his passion for travel. So I'm about to leave the residency and spend some time in Tanzania at the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center, where John Stewart, one of the early orthopedists in Seattle, and Ted Wagner had established kind of a rotation there. So Bob tells me, you got to go to Zanzibar, okay? And I said, great, it sounds wonderful. So he's telling me about the sandy beaches and the spices. And he said, you go to this, I can't remember the name of the hotel. So you go to this hotel and ask for a guy named Ali, and he will take you around and show you everything. So this seems unbelievable. So Beth and I are in Tanzania, in Moshi. We get a flight to Zanzibar at like 6-8 weeks later. We go to this hotel. We asked for Ali, and he's there, and he takes us all around Zanzibar. So Bob is a world traveler, and he often gives tips to individuals. So, Bob, I know you don't really like to do this sort of stuff, and I appreciate you doing that for Mo and I and letting the audience get to know you better, because you're kind of off doing other things, and you've had a great influence on many people's careers and on the field of orthopedic trauma, and congratulations, and I can't wait to see your coffee table book on Indian art. If you haven't done it already, I'm sure you're working on it.
You guys are both great. I really appreciate it. It's really nice talking with you. And it was nice seeing you back in Seattle, Mark.
It's terrific. Well, thanks again, Bob. And Mo, cheers. I got to wake up a little bit from jet lag. But, right. Thanks, everybody.
Take care.